This podcast is sponsored by Cloud Optimizer.
As a business owner or IT manager, are your cloud investment costs going up and you don't know why? It's time for Cloud Optimizer. As you migrate your business to the cloud, what you're spending and why you're spending it can get a little hazy. But Cloud Optimizer clears up the mystery and puts the cloud to work for you. Cloud Optimizer starts by analyzing usage patterns, right-sizing resources, leveraging discounts you may not be aware of, implementing automation, and much more. And by reducing unnecessary expenses and maximizing performance, Cloud Optimizer guarantees you a savings of 5 times what you spend for their service. As you utilize cloud-based services more and more, you don't have to lose sight or control of your spend. You can stay agile, streamline your costs, and optimize your performance, plus save significant money with Cloud Optimizer.
Make the cloud work for you with Cloud Optimizer. Get a free assessment and find out how much you can save by going to cloudoptimizer.com. Go to cloudoptimizer.com for your free assessment. That's cloudoptimizer.com.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
Ari Berman's got a name for what he does. He calls himself
a genealogist of many centuries of anti-democratic tactics and movements.
To be specific, Ari is a voting rights reporter at Mother Jones. He's written a new book, Minority Rule. It's all about how our political system got the way it is today. Anyway, as a political genealogist of a sort, Ari's been trying to trace the family tree of Trumpism.
And that's what took me to this lovely C-SPAN archives in the 1990s.
Who were you looking for there?
I was looking for Pat Buchanan.
So today we call for a new patriotism, where Americans begin to put the needs of Americans first.
Because Buchanan, in many ways, lays the groundwork for Trump.
If you don't remember Buchanan, it's because he was not very successful with voters. He ran 3 times for president. 1 year he won over New Hampshire Republicans, but that was it. A speech that sticks with Ari is from December 10th, 1991.
We must take America back.
Buchanan was announcing one of his ill-fated runs for the presidency. And you don't have to listen very closely to hear echoes of 2024.
We will put America first. And so, to take my party back and to take our country back, I am today declaring my candidacy for the Republican nomination for President of the United States.
It could be ripped from a presidential campaign today.
And that's the interesting thing, is that Trump is the one who ripped Buchanan, if you look at who ripped off who, because Buchanan basically came up with the America First platform that Trump adopts. In his view, America was under siege from immigrants, from the changing demographics of the country.
Yeah. I mean, back in 2016, someone tracked down Buchanan himself, and he said he had revisited this speech and was amazed that his words were resonating decades later.
He had what at the time was a very radical message. And I think that's the important thing to remember here, is when Trump says it, we just think, oh, this is how it's always been. But Buchanan was a deeply reactionary figure within the Republican Party.
If it was so radical at the time, if he lost the presidential nomination 3 times, how did his ideas survive?
Well, that's the interesting thing, is that the more extreme Buchanan becomes, the more popular his opinions become within the Republican Party.
Today on the show, the story of the man behind some of the Republican Party's most radical ideas. He lost at the ballot box. Why 30 years later, he might as well declare victory anyway. I'm Mary Harris. You're listening to What Next? Stick around. This episode is brought to you by Discover. When it comes to your finances, Discover wants you to know they are the credit card that is always there for you. With 24/7 US-based live customer service, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We are talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. This episode is brought to you by Discover. When it comes to your finances, Discover wants you to know they are the credit card that is always there for you. With 24/7 US-based live customer service, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We are talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. For the young people in the audience, people who may not remember, who is Pat Buchanan?
So he really came of age as a speechwriter to Richard Nixon.
He was a journalist, right?
He was a journalist. He grew up in a segregated neighborhood. He writes in his books that we had our neighborhood and African-Americans had theirs, basically. He grows up in this very conservative family, this very large Catholic family. His idols are people like General Francisco Franco in Spain, the Spanish dictator, Joe McCarthy, the rabidly anti-communist senator who leads a blacklist.
These are not like American heroes.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they're American heroes for some people, but more like people that are on the radical anti-democratic right. He became a journalist in St. Louis. He wrote lots of editorials in the early 1960s against things like the civil rights movement and against people like Martin Luther King. And then he goes and works for Richard Nixon, and he helps conceive of the Southern strategy, which is the strategy that Republicans use to convert conservative white voters from Democrats to Republicans by leading a backlash to the civil rights movement in the 1960s.
So white resentment was like baked in from the beginning with Pat Buchanan.
Yeah, I mean, I would argue that white resentment is Pat Buchanan's ideology. It's just, it's evolved over time from resentment towards blacks in the civil rights movement to resentment to voters of color and minority groups and demographic change more broadly. But I think white resentment is the constant in his career.
How did he decide to run for president?
So after working for Richard Nixon, he then goes and works for Ronald Reagan. And he gets a larger media perch. He's on all these TV shows. He's famously on the CNN show Crossfire.
And 75% to 80%, I think, of American parents and people want warning labels on these kind of records that they feel are salacious or anti-Semitic or racist. What is wrong with practicing a little democracy and letting the warning labels be placed there?
Basically, he doesn't like the Republican Party of George H.W. Bush because he views Bush as too moderate, too open on things like immigration, too pro-free trade. And he challenges an incumbent sitting president, which is a very radical thing to do.
And this is where we need to kind of pause and talk about the fact that just a couple of years before Buchanan was running his presidential campaign, there was this Census Bureau prediction that sort of laid out where the country was moving demographically. And it really became the basis for Buchanan's campaign, right?
Yeah. So the 1990 census predicts for the first time that white Americans will one day be a minority in the U.S. And it predicts that that day will happen in 2050.
Was this like headline news?
Yeah, it was headline news. I mean, it's fascinating to go back and look at it. It basically says that because of the growth of the minority population in the U.S., largely fueled by immigration, whites will be a minority one day.
In some states, people have projected, demographers have projected that Hispanics will actually become perhaps a majority in the next 30 years. Texas and California, they're about almost a fourth of the population already. Mexican Americans are growing in very strategic places in this country too, politically.
And Buchanan sees that and he starts warning against it. And he realizes that this could be a powerful issue for Republicans in the same way that the backlash against the civil rights movement was a powerful issue for Republicans in the 60s and 70s. he realizes that the backlash against demographic change and the coming white minority could be a very powerful issue for Republicans in the 90s and the decades after.
So in 1992, Buchanan loses to George H.W. Bush. But then 4 years later, he's back running again. How does his rhetoric change? What are the new policies he's calling for when it comes to immigration?
So he's calling for things like a Buchanan fence along the U.S.-Mexico border.
Sounds a lot like building a wall.
Yeah, exactly. That the Buchanan fence was the Trump wall.
The Army Corps of Engineers, for a small sum of money, could put together a mesh fence. It wouldn't look like the Berlin Wall. A sunken fence across the 66 miles of border where most of the crossings are taking place. You could double the border patrol and you could deal with that problem. Why is it that the President of the United States, who has the constitutional obligation to defend the states of the Union from illegal invasions, is not acting to defend his own frontiers?
Other things he's talking about are things like denying citizenship to children born to undocumented immigrants in the U.S., so repealing birthright citizenship. That's another thing Trump and his aides like Stephen Miller have talked a lot about. He's talking about a more border agents. He's talking about a moratorium on immigration altogether so that the country, in his words, can quote unquote Americanize, which is very reminiscent of Trump's Muslim ban. So Buchanan comes up with all these radical policies in immigration that then lay the groundwork for the Trump platform decades later.
It feels pretty obvious that Buchanan didn't invent racism. So what was he doing that was new here? Like, why do you see him as the root?
What he was doing that was new is he was mixing antipathy towards the civil rights movement in the 1960s with new warnings about demographic changes. What was new about Buchanan is he was fusing old-style racism with basically new-style racism, and he was warning about the dangers of a majority-minority country. And that was new for Republicans in the 1990s, and it was new in American politics. So Buchanan basically extends these culture war issues that have been around for a long time and starts waging them against immigration and the changing demographics of the country. And that is new in American politics in the 1990s.
Buchanan ran for office 3 times, 92, 96, 2000?
Yes, he ran for the Republican nomination in 92 and 96, and then he ran for the Reform Party nomination in 2000 because he left the Republican Party when he was basically kicked out of it for being too radical.
Yeah, I find this so interesting because Republicans were kind of trying to manage him in some way, but then it just seemed like he kept going.
They are. Well, they're trying to harness his issues. So he gives this speech in 92 at the Republican convention where he says we're in a cultural war for the soul of America.
Friends, this election is about more than who gets what. It is about who we are. It is about what we believe and what we stand for as Americans. There is a religious war going on in this country. It is a cultural war as critical to the kind of nation we shall be as the Cold War itself, for this war is for the soul of America.
But then in 96, the Republican Party nominates Bob Dole as their candidate. And Bob Dole is a senator from Kansas. He's very moderate for the time. And he's running against Bill Clinton, who's another moderate. So the battle for the votes is in the center. And Republicans don't want Buchanan around. They think he's too radical, too extreme. He's going to turn off too many moderate suburban voters with his existential warnings about the death of white America. And he's called Pitchfork Pat by the Washington Post columnist George Will. And he basically is denied a speaking spot at the 1996 Republican convention. By 2000, he's had it with the Bushes. He basically argues that the Republican Party has become pro-immigration, pro-free trade, pro-war party, and he doesn't want any part of it anymore. So he then joins Ross Perot's Reform Party, where, funnily enough, he briefly squares off against Donald Trump.
What did Trump have to say about him?
Trump said Buchanan was a racist. Pretty amazing. Trump goes and meet the press and he says,
look, he's a Hitler lover. I guess he's an anti-Semite. He doesn't like the blacks. He doesn't like the gays. It's just incredible that anybody could embrace this guy. And maybe he'll get 4 or 5% of the vote and it'll be a really staunch right wacko vote. I'm not even sure if it's right. It's just a wacko vote. And I just can't imagine that anybody can take him seriously.
I think it's important to talk about Pat Buchanan because even though he never came anywhere close to winning the Republican nomination, I think a lot of people, including myself maybe, saw his defeat at the ballot box and the way the Republican Party, you know, tried to kind of brush him aside as a kind of success. But the thing is, his ideas lived on, and the Republican Party kept making space for those ideas. What does that tell you about how we fight about these ideas and how we think about them? Because I think that you might think putting the messenger away is a way to silence the ideas, but it might not be.
Well, I think the popularity of Buchanan's ideas within the Republican Party, even as he becomes more of a fringe figure, just shows how the Republican Party is radicalizing more broadly, that they're open to things that previously were dismissed as fringe. They are radicalizing against immigration. They are radicalizing against demographic change. They are radicalizing against democracy more broadly. And to me, the tipping point for this is the election of Barack Obama as the first Black president, because that's really the first major, in a seismic way, evidence of the impact that demographic change is going to have.
Is it seen by some as basically proof? Like, oh, oof, we have a Black president, so that means this demographic change really is happening.
Exactly, exactly. Because when it's a bunch of white guys running and winning, a bunch of white Southerners being elected, it's not as easy to show that if it's a Bush or a Clinton. But when it's Obama and he's the first Black president and he's elected by this rainbow coalition, then Buchanan's warnings about white America becoming extinct and demographic change leading to big D Democratic victories starts to radicalize Republicans against demographic change and radicalize them against democracy more broadly. Because basically what Buchanan argues is that demographic change is going to warp democracy, that the new demographics are going to use democracy to boost their power. And so therefore, democracy itself should be a target, and that protecting the emerging white minority, which he calls it, is more important than extending democratic rights to formerly disenfranchised communities.
We'll be right back.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
You're not the first person to point out that Trump owes a lot to Pat Buchanan. But I am kind of curious about why you think Trump was so much more successful with Buchanan's ideas. I think some have basically speculated Trump's success is about timing. Like, all of a sudden, it seemed more resonant, this argument about white resentment. Is that what you think as well? Or do you think it's something else?
I think it's timing, and also it's better packaging. I think Trump wanted to be Buchanan without the baggage. He wanted to be the guy that took this America First platform, but used it in a celebrity kind of way to market it to a much broader population. So if Buchanan was kind of this angry white guy who was standing on the sidelines, Trump was the guy who rode the golden escalator down Trump Tower, but was saying many of the racist, nativist, anti-immigrant things that Buchanan was, but just gave it a kind of celebrity touch. And the fact is, the timing mattered a lot, because the majority-minority future that Buchanan had long warned about was closer now in 2016 or in 2020 than it was in 1990. And the reality of a Black president and those kind of things had sunk in, and the Republican Party had already begun radicalizing against democracy and radicalizing against demographic change before Trump. And that led to an opening that Trump was able to exploit in a way that Buchanan could not.
Part of what's interesting to me about your reporting is you've taken an event like January 6th, and you've been like, you can see the white racial resentment in that event based on who came.
Yeah. There was a really interesting study that was released by the University of Chicago about the insurrectionists on the one-year anniversary of January 6th. And it had a surprising conclusion because it actually found that the insurrectionists were not from the reddest or most rural places where the Republican Party is strongest. The insurrectionists were most likely to be from counties that had a significant decline in the white population. In many ways, demographic change was the best predictor of whether someone would become an insurrectionist. And the insurrectionists not only came from places that were experiencing major demographic change, but they also held views on demographic change that were fueled by racial resentment. So they believed in things like the Great Replacement Theory, that immigrants were coming to take the place from white America and that Democrats were importing them into the country so that they would vote for the Democratic Party, things that Trump has said very openly in 2024. So the backlash that Pat Buchanan started in the 1990s to the changing demographics of the country leads somewhat directly to the insurrection at the Capitol on January 6th.
Yeah. You know, there are some studies right now and polls that are showing that the GOP is actually getting more diverse, slowly. How does that play in to this push to politically weaponize racial resentment?
Well, that's a fascinating question. And I think we're going to have to wait and see on it, because it's unclear to me if the Republican Party is becoming more popular with minority voters or Joe Biden is just becoming more unpopular with minority voters. So I don't know if this is a Biden-specific thing. We didn't see major shifts among voters of color in the 2022 election, for example, at the state level. One thing that I think that Republicans are doing is I think they're trying to pit different minority groups against each other.
What do you mean when you say that?
I think they've been quite effective about it. For example, there was a big push on the right to try to use, for example, the Black Lives Matter movement to try to court Latino and Asian American voters who they argued were threatened by the demonstrations and the protests and the rise in Black power. So I think the Republican Party, to me, is playing a more complicated game right now. They're not necessarily trying to turn off all minority voters, but they are trying to peel off minority voters through specific racial appeals that might demonize one immigrant group, but not another. And even with immigration, it's complicated because they're trying to court a lot of conservative Hispanics, places like South Texas, by arguing that all of these undocumented immigrants are coming across the border to take American jobs and to take their job. But I don't think this has gotten a lot of coverage, that the Republican Party is diversifying. But let's be real. The Republican Party at its core is still a white party. It's always been a white party since the civil rights movement of the 1960s. And white resentment is still core to the popularity of the Republican Party and the popularity of Donald Trump today.
I mean, the census now suggests that white Americans will technically be a minority by 2045, which is 5 years earlier than 2050, which is the statistic that made Pat Buchanan so incensed when he was first running for president.
Yeah, and that's why I think the Republican Party has become so committed to raising the issue of immigration, because I think they view that this is not just a political issue for them, but I think they think it's an issue of electoral power. The warnings of immigration, they're doing it for cultural reasons, they're doing it for political reasons, but I think they're just also worried about shifting notions of electoral power. And Buchanan basically says the Republican Party needs to put an end to mass immigration, or mass immigration will put an end to the Republican Party.
But if this demographic shift is inevitable, doesn't this strategy of trying to, you know, fan the flames of white resentment, doesn't it have a natural expiration date? Because eventually those people will not be all the people voting.
I mean, that's the fascinating question right now. With the country heading towards a majority minority country, do you try to become a majority party that embraces the new American majority, or do you try to become a party that's fixated on minority rule to stop the majority from having its fair share of political power?
For Republicans, what does minority rule look like if they got everything that they wanted?
I mean, what minority rule means is that Republicans would never have to get a majority of votes or represent a majority of Americans, but they would hold a majority of political power. And we're heading towards that situation right now. I mean, that already exists in a lot of ways. I mean, you look at the Supreme Court, 5 of 6 conservative justices have been appointed by Republican presidents who initially lost the popular vote and were confirmed by senators elected by a minority of Americans. So the Supreme Court is already a product of minority rule. And then, of course, it's issued decisions that have overturned very popular things like Roe v. Wade, like the Voting Rights Act, like gun control measures to enshrine minority rule. And I think if the Republican Party had its way, it would just extend minority rule to all of the institutions that it doesn't already control. The fact is, the country is becoming more diverse. Very powerful figures in the Republican Party and the conservative movement feel threatened by it, and they've tried to create a fortress of anti-democratic tactics to stop what they view as the coming siege.
You know, Pat Buchanan, he's still alive, right?
He is. I wasn't able to get an interview with him. He's retired from writing, and I don't know how great his health is. But he was writing, you know, as of a year ago, he was still publishing columns, but he's kind of retreated from public view right now.
If you could, what would you ask him?
I would ask him if he feels like he laid out the blueprint for the Republican Party's broader embrace of minority rule, and if he has any regrets that things that he advocated for ended up leading to catastrophic events like the insurrection at the Capitol. And basically, does he feel vindicated, which I imagine he does, or does he feel to some extent like he has blood on his hands?
Ari, I'm really grateful for your time. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks so much, Mary. Always great to talk to you.
Ari Berman is the National Voting Rights Correspondent over at Mother Jones. His new book is called Minority Rule: The Right-Wing Attack on the Will of the People and the Fight to Resist It. And that's our show. What Next is produced by Paige Osborne, Elena Schwartz, Rob Gunther, Madeline Ducharme, and Anna Phillips. We are led by Alicia Montgomery with a little boost from Susan Matthews. Ben Richmond is the Senior Director of Podcast Operations here at Slate. And I'm Mary Harris. Thanks for listening. Catch you back here next time.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.